You're listening to Speak Free with Simon O'Connor, right here on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
Well, I'm very excited having my next guest, amongst other things, he's a friend. His name's Brendan Malone. Hopefully you've heard of him, you've come across his work. He's prolific. So I'm going to welcome him, and then I'm going to explain a little bit more. But Brendan, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Simon. Prolific is bad if you're a serial killer. It's hopefully good in my case. It's very kind of you to say.
Well, I've known you for years, and I can certify without doubt you're not a serial killer. And actually, we're going to touch on, I think, a topic that's going to really engage and fascinate listeners, just to really up the ante on you today, which is around the rise of the managerial class. And something that you talk about is technocracy. And I think actually a lot of listeners have actually experienced technocracy and the rise of the managerial class in their lives over recent years, but may not have the words to have understood it. And we're going to talk about that today because amongst many things, we should introduce you. You are a cultural commentator. You run something called LifeNet New Zealand. You're a podcaster. I think On the Dispatches is one of your podcasts. You're, as I say, prolific. So just quickly tell listeners a bit about the work that you are doing.
Well, it's fair to say for the last 20 years, well, it's 20 years in October, I've been working full-time in this space where I spend a lot of time engaging at conferences and universities, churches, schools, and other events. And my specialty really is around sort of bioethics and life ethics and issues like that. And I would describe my work as really being, I think, I often like to call myself, maybe I'm a little bit too grandiose, but a cultural missionary, trying to suggest to people that the Christian vision of reality is actually a profoundly beautiful one. Even if you're not a Christian believer, it has shaped the world in profound ways. It has shaped our Western mind in ways that we really take for granted. And if we move away from, I don't think we'll be too happy about. In fact, I think we're seeing a lot of that now. And then there's the podcasting. And I know some of your listeners will be familiar with the Dispatches podcast because I know I have feedback from people during COVID when I started that. A lot of people have said to me, look, I found the Dispatches a really helpful sort of little oasis that I could go to when I wasn't sure what was going on, when I was under pressure, when I had to contemplate the big ethical questions we were all forced to confront during that period. And I wanted to know that I wasn't losing my mind. And I also wanted to have a sense that I wasn't going to end up in any sort of strange out there territory. So I was very grateful for that kind of feedback. And I know some of your listeners have probably encountered some of my content. In particular, I did a podcast that episode that really took off about where I shared what it was like the first time I actually had to go out, I guess, into the world and engage with the community as an unvaccinated person after the mandates and after all the restrictions came in. And I just shared honestly about the challenge that was. And a lot of people really resonated with that particular episode.
Which is, I think, one of the great strengths, actually, you bring. And just so listeners know, this is not just going to be Brendan and I firing compliments at each other or funny or funny dad jokes, but actually you provide a very clear and elegant voice. And I do know a lot of listeners and others beyond RCR who have been grateful to you. So, in fact, what we're talking about today is it sort of does come out not of COVID days, but it certainly is well expressed in those. Is this concept of technocracy, you talk about it quite frequently, and the rise of a managerial class. So having you on is a chance to explain, well, to me and to listeners, what you mean by these terms. So talk us through them.
Well, I think we need to take a big step back about 300 or 400 years BC and understand something that was happening there with Plato. And Plato talks about the idea of he's in favor of an oligarchy. We're ruled by oligarchy. And we tend to use that as a bit of a pejorative, a bit of a negative term today. Oh, an oligarchy. But in actual fact, if you look at Plato's ideas and his philosophy on this, he doesn't envisage like an elite group of probably what we've got today, a group of fat cats and elites and people who haven't really, or not really virtuous in any sense. They've just got power and they wield it over people. He's not talking about any sort of authoritarian regime that just appoints itself. Instead, his idea of oligarchy is that you'd be a person of virtue and wisdom, and these are the qualities, plus probably some basic management, as in, he wouldn't say management, governance probably would be more a term they would talk about back then, those basic skills. And when they talk about governance skills, they don't mean so much a technical skill like we would think of today. They would think, is this person of good character? Can they manage their own affairs well? Do they manage their own household well? Are they a good leader in that way? You know, a person of character and virtue. And he sees the ideal as having an oligarchy that would rule And they would be the ones who are most suitable to govern large groups of people and to do it well and with virtue. Now, fast forward a bit to about the middle of the 1500s, and you have from sort of 1560 when he's born onwards right through to the early 1600s, you have the philosophy of Francis Bacon come to the fore. And Francis Bacon now takes this whole idea of oligarchy in a very different direction. He is more focused. He's the father of the modern scientific revolution and what we would call today appropriately empiricism, the idea that only empirically provable things can lay claim to be, you know, true. Anything else, you can believe it as an individual if you want, but it can't lay claim to the whole community. And so in other words, can you test it according to the rules of science or under a microscope, things like that. And he has this idea, knowledge is power. As our knowledge of the natural world grows, so we will free ourselves from the restraint of nature, the enslavement of that, and our science and prowess will grow. And so all of a sudden our oligarchy shifts. And oligarchy is no longer about virtue and wisdom now. Oligarchy becomes about technical expertise. They're the most suitable people. And so, in fact, before he died, he wrote, but he didn't finish, a utopian fictional work called The New Atlantis. And The New Atlantis was about a world that was governed by scientists. And so technocrats would actually control. Now, most of us probably had never given the idea of technocracy much of a second thought until COVID. And when COVID hit, all of a sudden, trust the experts. We were under governance, we discovered, by technocracy and technocrats, people who had knowledge. And that was, they gave special authority to these people just because they had a particular scientific knowledge. And then what happened was, after that, we started to, I guess a lot of people woke up and realized, holy moly, we've been living under technocracy in various forms for a long time. So whenever I hear today people talking about the deep state, for example, in America, they're really talking about unelected bureaucrats and technocrats who make decisions that are the power behind the throne, and they are really responsible for shaping so much of our lives. And like I said, under COVID, we really saw, effectively, there were big periods where our government outsourced its actual duty of care over to a very tiny group of unelected experts and was effectively telling them, well, you know, you tell us what to do and we'll just do that.
Says me. A great summation, because I think you're right. We woke up. It had to be through a crisis, really, because this has been going on for a long, long time. And, you know, the essence ultimately is that, you know, we're replacing good character and good virtues with the idea of science. And I, certainly from my side, and I think yours as well, you know, technology is good. It's amazing. Yeah. I mean, the fact that RCR exists is because of technology. We were able to actually connect through the internet, through apps and so forth. So we're not saying to listeners that technology is bad, but it's more that it when it becomes the driver and when it's wielded or held by a select few. And again, yeah, COVID's a perfectly good example of it. But there's been a lot of technologies now. I mean, gosh, I even think of social media. Yeah. You know, these are not elected people, but they hold enormous sway and influence on us. Well, I think so. I mean, would you see the likes of Meta or Facebook, Twitter and so on as being part of that technocracy because they control what we see, hear, arguably what we think?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it would be a mistake just to say, well, technology equals technocracy. You're right. C.S. Lewis was very aware of this, and he was actually, he had Francis Bacon squarely in his sights. So first of all, C.S. Lewis would say, you know, when people today talk about the science, you know, trust the science, he would say, what do you mean? It's the sciences, not just one science. It's not like a priestly class of doctrine. It is actually a group of different scientific disciplines. And then he would also say that in actual fact, any new power that we gain over nature, despite what Bacon might want to believe, is also ultimately a power over other human beings as well. It's a power over humanity because we're part of the natural world. And so what that means is that he was very cogent and cognizant of the fact that the danger here was that power would be turned, you know, each new power would be a power over other human beings and that a small group of scientific experts would end up governing the rest of us. In fact, he wrote a dystopian novel, one of the great dystopias called That Hideous Strength. And it's about a future England that is governed by a group of scientific experts. It's a technocracy. They're called the National Institute for Coordinated Experiments. NICE. Got a lovely acronym. And basically, we discover that when we, as this nefarious plot of theirs unfolds to build this new utopia in England, the hero discovers at the very end that their headquarters, when he breaks into their headquarters, that they are taking their orders from the reanimated head of Francis Bacon. So it's very clear what he's saying. So what Lewis was like, no, science itself is not evil or wrong. But what you have with scientific power is you need to have it under virtue, under moral guidance. Otherwise, it will just be raw power and it will be used by people because power is an aphrodisiac. People love to wield it. They love to get close to it. Why is it, Simon, that when you're in the political world, everyone is drawn to you because they get a sense maybe I can actually get close to the seat of power, possibly even have some of that for myself. It's a very compelling kind of thing. And so he called, Lewis called science the magician's twin. And he said, look, you know, a magician pretends to do magic, but it's not real. It's an illusion. They can't make rabbits disappear, but a scientist can actually do real and very powerful things. They can split an atom, but they can't tell you morally what you should do with that knowledge about, you know, atomic knowledge. What should we do with it? Should we build a power plant or should we drop a weapon on civilians? He said, that's beyond the competency of science. The problem is we've forgotten that and we're acting as if the scientific classes and the scientific planners are the new gods, the new priestly classes. And can I say, a very shocking example of where you see Francis Bacon married up to, you know, sort of like technocracy in a very diabolical way, and throw in a bit of Darwinian thought as well, and that is the pseudoscience of eugenics, where they said, well, look, you know, Darwin's told us that nature intends for us to be fitter, and it favours fitness. We've got this power. Knowledge is power. Let's unshackle ourselves from the restraints of nature. Let's use this technology to breed a better class of human beings, to sterilize those who are unfit. And the Nazis even said to euthanize those who are the wrong stock. And you see how technocracy and power in science plays out without a moral compass in a very disastrous way there.
And I think that's the critical point for me, amongst others, is that, again, technology is not bad. Science is not bad. But it needs to be anchored or tethered to the, if you will, the other sciences, such as the humanities, the ethics, moral codes, culture, and so forth. Because actually, you've just mentioned eugenics. Most people's minds will jump back to the 1920s and 30s, for example. But actually, it's in play now. Go to Finland, where preborn babies are tested, and if they oh my God, my brain's Down syndrome.
Yeah, Down syndrome, that's right.
They're eliminated. And so, yeah, there's the science, if you will, the technology being deployed. I would argue, and I suspect you would as well, that without that human ethical consideration.
Yeah, and do you know one of the first acts you realize there's a problem here, and it's very much grounded in that Greek natural law tradition, is Hippocrates, who gave us the Hippocratic Oath. He realizes, because back in the time before, medicine wasn't what we think of it today. It's a very Christianized practice generally today. You know, the doctor is there to help you and to care for you. That is a very Christian conceptualization of what medicine was. But this shift starts under Hippocrates, because back in the day, a doctor was someone who just had an advanced level of biology and chemistry and things like that, according to the knowledge and the limits they had at their time. But you could go to a doctor and sure, you could get a cure for a sore foot, or you could pay them to produce a poison to kill an enemy. They were like mercenaries. The technology was there, but there was no virtue governing it. And Hippocrates shifts that. He starts the shift where he says, no, I will do no harm. And that is now the first and most important principle of human ethics. That's a big shift away. So in other words, this technology, for it to be virtuous, must be put at the service of good, truth, and ultimately, obviously, human flourishing. And when that's not happening, that's when you've got a very serious problem. And I think one of the big issues we're grappling with today is in our culture, we've lost sight of the authentic good. We don't have a sacred, moral, transcendent religious vision to give us our moral code. And so what do we rely on? Well, probably the predominant moral philosophy is utilitarianism. The end justifies the mean. But as we've said, that doesn't fix the technocracy problem. Because, well, why can't you just drop atomic weapons on a whole lot of innocent civilians and slaughter them if you're going to produce a better outcome by doing that? There's no restriction there on the power. Probably the closest we've got to rely on outside of Christianity would be Kantian ethics, which draws on Christianity anyway, which is, you know, Kant's categorical imperative that a human person must never be treated as a means to an end. They are good in and of themselves. It's basically his expression of Christ when he says, you know, do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. And so I don't want an atomic bomb dropped on me, so I would, on my kids, I wouldn't do that to others. But that's the closest we've got now, and it's a pretty thin veneer because I mean, we don't tend to think of ourselves as having much accountability for the power that we wield. Why can't we just do this, Simon? We can make the world better. Why shouldn't we?
Oh, we have the power. We have the science. Therefore, we should just do it.
Yeah, exactly.
And you'll see, I would argue, a lot of things happening in today's society. I mean, I don't think for time we should go down the rabbit hole of what they call gender-affirming surgery, very euphemistically, you know, the mutilating of children. But just because we can do it doesn't mean we should do it. Yep. But you are seeing, I would argue, even if you use that example, certainly the COVID days, we did end up with, and I would argue still, Brennan, we have this priestly class, a dogmatic class now of the technocrats, or some, to be fair, who do just dominate. I'm the expert. And because this can be done, it will be done. And anyone else who has a contrary opinion gets stomped on. And on top of that, too, we've dehumanized at times a lot of the science. You talked at the start about, you know, stepping out into the world, in your case, of an unvaccinated side of things. I mean, I still remember all the signs, the app that people, I refuse to use it, I have to admit. But all these technologies developed to actually control us without arguably that ethical oversight.
No.
We weren't even able to have conversations.
No, and it was very interesting to me that, and I remember talking about this at the time on the podcast, that there was no proper moral discernment and prudential discernment on people's part. They were just saying, okay, save us, make us safe. Fear didn't help. There was a widespread cultivated climate of fear, and that really amplified the power of technocracy because people would like say, okay, tell us what to do and we'll do it, because they were desperate, right? They didn't realize that they didn't need to be that desperate because the fear had been amped up. But then people would just embrace these technologies and say, yeah, it's great that I can be in a store with this tracking technology and it will tell me when I've been near another COVID-infected, awful plague rat of a person. And
I'm thinking, unclean. Yeah,
exactly. And I'm thinking, are you stopping to consider how your personal movements are being tracked through all of this and what you're actually surrendering here for the perceived promise of safety? Is it really worth the price that you're paying, and how much are you giving over to technocrats here, you know, areas of our lives where they really shouldn't be for an authentic humanity to flourish?
Oh, look, I can tell you, having been somewhat on the inside, you know, as someone who's very interested in ethics and philosophy, trying to raise a lot of these aspects with people, you know, particularly when you're into a mandated space, or as you say, the use of technology. I'm a great one for privacy. That enormous, again, one of the reasons I didn't want to use and didn't use the app is it was giving so much data. But to even have the conversations were nearly impossible.
Yeah.
Nearly impossible. That imperative, that technological imperative.
Well think about how it shaped your thinking about others too. So it distorts our humanity because, first of all, we think, okay, I'm safe. I've got this piece of technology. It's almost transhumanism. We marry ourselves up to the technology to become safer and better as human beings. And then what happens is we now start to develop new, unnatural, and very unhealthy fears where we start to become afraid to get too close to other people because our device is telling us that we should be that way. And you remember all these incidents, and my wife encountered this and others I know, where they just had close encounters that are very normal and not even that close with people in a supermarket, and people would freak out about it because the technocracy and the technology had actually created more of a problem in that regard.
Well, I suppose too, as parents, we can see even just the use of technology in young people and how it's affecting. I mean, listeners have heard me reference Dr. Jonathan Haidt before, that, you know, how, you know, the studies, the data clearly shows that, you know, the anxiety, the depression that a lot of our young people feel is actually linked to digital devices. That technology, detached from a good human ethic, becomes problematic. But the other part we would very briefly at the start touched on is this rise of managerial class. And you mentioned just a bit earlier about, you know, particularly there's a Judeo-Christian set of values which is sort of underpins society, whether one's a believer or not. But as we seem to be pulling back from that, and I'll phrase this as a statement and you can pull it apart. as we've pulled back from that, if you will, that common understanding or that particular ethic, we've replaced it with more and more laws, more and more regulation, more and more bureaucrats, more and more people responsible to tell us what to do. I mean, we've never had so many laws and regulations as we do across all elements of life that we didn't used to. Didn't need someone to tell me how to make my house safe or exactly around elements of schooling, what my kids need to know or not. I used to teach it as a parent, but now the government's taken over again, rules and regulations. Is that Is that what you mean by this rise of a managerial class?
Yeah, I'm thinking here particularly of Burnham and his very important work on managerialism and this idea that we take this for granted today because we just live under this managerial bureaucratic regime. All these unelected policy officials and bureaucrats who run this faceless process-driven system, we didn't vote for them. They work in the background, they create the policies. Even the politicians, I'm not sure, have much accountability over them. It's this giant monolith of a thing. And I'm sure you could share your own insights about this from someone who's been on the inside as well. But the reality is that this thing that we are now sort of governed by is actually, not only is it, I think, unnatural to the human state, but it's not normal. If you go back 90, 100 years, this was not how governance was done. There was a lot more subsidiarity, respect and empowerment at the local, smaller level, at the lower levels. Now it's all centralized and it's all driven by bureaucrats and bureaucratic policy. And the thing is that it's really, I mean, it's part of it is there's a shift that happens post-industrial revolution. I don't think we quite appreciate how much that changed our world. That broke down the family as a complete economic unit by taking the dad out of the home and putting him in a factory for hours on end. And then the mum was at home. She was no longer part of the economic wealth, and neither were the kids. And then that had an impact upon relationships and how much do you see your parents. And then after that, we start to get enamored with technology because it looks very promising. In fact, it looks so promising that in that sort of post-industrial revolution, late 1800s, early 1900s, you've got people, even in Christian theological circles, who are suggesting maybe this is the kingdom of heaven on earth is going to come through this new technological development. It's going to be a beautiful utopia. Well, then what happens? You have the stock market crash, and economic technology proves to be hopeless. You then get two world wars within close succession and a massive pandemic, and all of a sudden, particularly with the advent of mechanized warfare and the barbarism, it must have been like hell on earth for those men who first entered that, from cavalry charges and swords and rifles to all of a sudden shelling and tanks and gassing. And then World War II, industrial scale mechanized genocide. All of a sudden, that whole utopian idea went right out the window and people realized it wasn't quite that simple. But after World War II, what we start to see is the rise of managerialism as this new science. And we forget that. We forget that management is a type of science as well. And this idea, it's really FDR's presidency and then Truman after him when he dies, they take this to a global level. FDR in particular is a big fan of this idea, this new management science. You could manage your way to a better society and a better world at a global level. Another one is J. Edgar Hoover with the FBI. We will bring management and scientific technology to law enforcement, and you can manage through science, the science of management and the science of use of science itself to a better outcome. And it really starts to dominate more and more and more. And we take it for granted today. And the reach of the government, the reach of the state into our daily lives through bureaucracy. Like you talked about a house before. Yeah, you own your own house, but how much of it do you own if you have to get permission to, I don't know, switch out a light switch? it's a very strange relationship now we have.
Oh, it is. And I just want to bring out two parts. I mean, one is that, as I say, we've definitely seen a growth of management. It doesn't matter if it's corporate governance or management in itself or HR or health and safety. And certainly, you know, I would argue, and it's just a very quick perspective, that, you know, we are forgetting the lessons of the past. You talked about the stock market crash and the wars, but, you know, we are seeing now both in New Zealand and across the globe more and more people trying to manage us towards another utopia. Yeah. You know, if only we could all gather our economies and we do this and all these different treaties and agreements and we can just form a perfect world, but we'll just manage it. And yeah. I say that quite deliberately because it is a us-them dynamic at times because a lot of us don't get to have that say.
No.
And I'd argue even as a now former politician, we didn't get a lot of say because there is that managerial class, and we're partly to blame.
Well, Simon, think about your time in politics. How often would you see in a select committee, or even yourself, you have to rely on a report from a group of experts to tell you, and rightly so, you don't want to be unwise and jump into something you don't know, but you're really dependent on the technocrats and their reports that they produce to tell you what to do.
Oh, yeah, and you know, a lot of the times brilliant, other times it ends up playing a game backwards and forwards, yep. And it's absurd. And now, you know, I mean, the stories of ministers, regardless if they're blue or red, but, you know, they've got their officials, but then they create a secondary level of people they can talk to try and see who's saying the right thing. And as I say, politicians, and it's our fault over many generations, has actually created so many laws now that actually hand the power over to the managerial class. So for people listening to understand, most of our laws don't prescribe each and every step. And I'm trying to think of a quick example. But what tends to happen is a law is passed that says, oh, there will be reports. It doesn't say what type of reports, how often, what needs to be in them. That power, that regulation is handed over to a managerial class to
Simon, a good example is euthanasia. 3 years, there'll be a report, and then every 5 years after that. But who decided on the structure of the current report? Well, we've got the Ministry of Health reviewing itself. That was all decided. The two-tier structure of the current report, who would be doing it, it was all just. And now most people, I think, in their minds would have thought, oh, there's going to be an independent review. It's not what that meant. It was up to the bureaucrats to decide.
It's a great example because actually even what's to be in the report's not decided by the politicians of the day. It's nameless, often faceless people who hide behind another element of the managerial dynamics, which is, of course, the OIA, the Official Information Act. Very, very difficult to get information. But the last thing I thought we might, if you don't mind touching on, is about the reach of power today being quite deep and profound and all around us, all around us. You mentioned the light switch. I think about the rules of how many bees and chickens and other things I'm allowed to keep in my house and so forth. But you talked about kings. This was before we came into the call or went live, was, you know, the kings of old are supposedly great and powerful, but actually they didn't have the reach into the depths that they do today, or this, you know, technocracy and managerial class does. Do you want to elaborate on that for listeners?
Well, one of the things I'm really discovering is the importance of reading history. And I've been saying that a lot to my listeners lately, read history. And in fact, I've started a sort of semi-regular series of trying to give people little episodes of the podcast, which are a little bit more well-produced with music and sound effects, to give them these little historical moments, to give them a sense of some of the stuff. Because if you read history, you start to learn a lot about wisdom and prudence, I think. You learn from the past. And one thing that's very apparent to me a lot more now reading history, of particularly through the Middle Ages, there's this sort of urban legend of the king who was all-powerful and wielded this divine right. But in actual fact, he really wasn't that powerful. The king, first of all, the separation of powers is an idea that goes right back to the Jewish religious tradition, where you have the king and then you have the priestly class, and they hold the law of Moses, and he's accountable to, effectively like a judiciary. And so they both have limiting powers, and so that carried on through the Middle Ages. But there's no bureaucratic mechanisms for a king to use to come into your home or to your estate and to govern your life. They actually had very little reach. And not just that, the other thing about managerialism is it's increasingly about managing outcomes, predetermined outcomes. It's not a process that starts democratically and ends democratically. The outcome is what they want, and then they manage it and use the process to manage to the outcome. And you think, oh, we had a whole series of hooies around the country. We must have been heard. No, the outcome was already decided. The hooies were there just to give a sort of semblance of authenticity and integrity to what was already a predetermined outcome. Well, the king didn't have that power. He couldn't determine things. He was restricted by the priestly class in the medieval world. And he was, you know, there was various limitations on what he could and couldn't do. He didn't wield great mechanisms. Wealth was a big factor, of course, as well. And so it's a very different world that we live in now in that regard. And I think the danger is very much in the way that it's reshaping our humanity away from an authentic and communal relational one to a one that is very mechanistic. It's determined by function. And it's not just we are becoming more machine-like, which was always the big fear through the 70s and 80s, you know, the rise of the human machine, but it's we are now cogs in a machine more and more increasingly. And when you try and engage with the bureaucratic managerial classes, where's the person to talk to keep that accountable? You'd finally get to talk to a faceless bureaucrat after the AI-driven automation system lets you do that. And then what happens? You get told, well, look, I'd love to help you, Simon, but, I'm just working here and the rules are decided somewhere else. Well, where can I go? Well, you go down to that department. It's like being in China, probably. In fact, I don't know, maybe it's even better, I don't know. But China, you know, you get sent, these famous stories being sent to these various communist departments. No, go to that department. No, go to that department. They can solve your problem. And at the end of the day, you've walked around 20 departments and none of them actually have the power to solve your problem.
Well, I mean, so many of us will know, you've called up your bank or your insurance, whatever it is, and you just all you're hearing is automation. It's like, just give me a person. Yeah. I just want to talk to a person. I think you've touched on something quite critical there. So I think I want to hold you, which is that relational side of things. I mean, one of the signs of a managerial class dynamic or a technocracy is we do lose relationship, and that could be some of the most fundamental. And so, yeah, we've talked, you know, just very quickly, the example of banking and insurance, but more personally, we've lost our say in a lot of things. I think that's why a lot of people get frustrated and angry. I certainly saw it as a politician at the time, of people feeling very disconnected. I want to have a say, Simon, and I can't get it. Or even when they'd come to select committee on whatever the topic was, many sort of knew it was just theater, you know, governments, the bureaucrats, whoever had made a decision. But I think about examples are in my mind at the moment. I mean, obviously, we talk COVID, so around your health choices, for example, out the window, some of the most fundamental rights to believe you couldn't go to church. But wider than that now, you know, your relationship to your children, that's been undermined, I would argue, more and more. I mean, control of the curriculum, finding out what they're teaching your children, the fact that they can even now start using pronouns for your child without telling you, whip them out the back for an abortion quicker than they could actually give you them a Panadol. I mean, it's like, whoa, 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 I'm losing that relationship. This managerial system is, or am I going off the, have I just gone off the reservation?
No, because here's the thing. You've made me, something I think is important that really we should mention, is that politics is also now a science. It's part of the technocracy. There are technocrats who specialize in the science of politics. And that's about the wielding of power for your outcomes. You could probably say it traces back to Machiavelli in particular. There's that growing awareness of how you can use power. But it's in the modern era, politics itself is a tool that is wielded by technocrats. And they are very aware and unfortunately have taken their cues from the worst examples in the world, particularly the Marxist example, is that you, for example, get the minds of the young. You reform and reshape their minds. You restructure society so the individual is part of a collective rather than actually part of a community. You make them as an individual prior to even family or community. That, you know, so children, the state consistently in our policy is driven by a liberal outlook on the world where children are not part of a family, the first and most important community first, they're individuals first. It doesn't matter that they're 5 years old. What about their agency? Even in a classroom. It astounds me to constantly hear in education now, but what about student agency? And I say, yeah, but you're the wise one. You're supposed to impart wisdom. And as they get older, they will learn about agency and they'll be able to wield it well. They're not ready to wield that yet. So why such a big sort of idolization of agency? Because we view everyone as individuals and we tend to slot them into the machine. But at the same time, you're not really an individual. Because if you don't fit what the function that you're supposed to fit, you know, if you're not going to serve the economy or what the society expects, then they sort of wash their hands of you. They don't know what to do with you. And you'll see that increasingly, I think, with technocracy is that you start to, everyone starts to be siloed and put into little boxes of expectation. And if you don't conform or you can't, then increasingly a technocracy-driven, efficiency-focused machine has no use of you. And that's a very frightening sort of dystopian thought, isn't it?
It is. And actually, you've highlighted, though, I'd say there's a convenience at play, though, in this dynamic, because at times you're right, individualism is stressed. But I'd argue, too, that collectivism, as opposed to community, also becomes stressed when it's convenient. So it's all well and good, as you were illustrating, you know, with children. Oh, no, they're an individual. We have to let them express themselves. I can't impart any truth upon them, so on and so forth. So great emphasis on the individual, or even if, you know, some elements are within a sort of a virtue ethic quite destructive, like, no, we just have to let you be you. But on the flip side, they will then move very quickly to collectivism. Oh, no, you can't choose to do or say this because actually it will harm the group. And I would argue you're seeing that in the free speech space at the moment. Oh, no, Simon, Brendan, you can't have that view as an individual because it harms this group over here. And again, I'm sorry, we just keep going back. Well, I'm like, sorry, but COVID sort of the perfect example. Our individual rights went flying out the window because the collective, whatever that was deemed to need to be protected.
The team of 5 million, wasn't it? Remember that?
Oh, God. Oh, don't traumatize us
all
with that.
Sorry, but, yeah, back into that.
But it is that, you know, facetiousness aside, that was it, that the team trumped the individual. And so if you had to be ostracized, mandated, et cetera, that was deemed acceptable by the managerial and, to be fair, the political class.
Well, and you're right. And the interesting thing about this, you contemplate that for a second. Who joined the team? No one did. You were all co-opted into the team. Who decided what the team would be? Not us, a group of technocrats. Who planned the campaign to sell us the concept of the team? A group of technocrats. We're seeing even now in some other countries, like we've discovered in recent months, that the United Kingdom, in response to, for example, terror attacks, they've had pre-planned internal, non-organic campaigns to try and bring the collective together that are not actually... So, you know, don't look back in anger was one of them. It was a technocrat-designed PR campaign. And you realise that what's actually happening here is that it's not a question of individualism. It is about our humanity and a respect for the human person and the relational nature. And there's also, I think, a great infantilizing that comes with it. You are no longer trusted as a human person. You can't be trusted. I'm sorry, Simon. You must do what we tell you to do. And then we give you a sort of infantilizing, cajoling sort of syrupy speech that's not real, like you're a toddler. Come on, join the team. You know you want to. And again, it's this loss of humanity. It's a loss of trust in the human person and a loss of subsidiarity and the goodness of the person. And what's interesting to note is I know there's some new research out recently about vaccine mandates in New Zealand for healthcare workers. And what they discovered was that they actually lost people once they went with the hard mandate. People were actually more willing to give of themselves, but all of a sudden, once they realized there was a coercion effect, they became less trusting. So even the technocrats are not delivering through this particular methodology what they hope to, and that's where you get a real problem. They start to realize, we might need to break a few eggs to make an omelette. Because, you know, we might need to use force because our goals are pure. Our utopian collectivist desire is a good thing. Why wouldn't we just break a few eggs to get the omelette?
Well, we see that example, I'd argue, very well in the free speech space when mainstream media will often make an example of someone who's said something that they've deemed incorrect. They're often pilloried within the papers and embarrassed and shamed. Cancelled, not just to destroy them and their views, but to make sure that everyone else takes the warning. And that's a bit of that infantilism that you're at as well. Like, there's a class of people who know it all. We'll tell you what to do. We know the technology. We know how things are going to work. The rest of you just, you're babies. Just be quiet. Don't say anything. Don't get in the way. Brendan, I better leave it there. As typical with me, I end up talking much, much long. I'm going to have to be texting some other guests now to tell them we're next week.
Sorry about that.
No apologies needed. This has been a great and I hope stimulating conversation. So, Brendan, thank you for coming on, and undoubtedly we'll have you back because your cultural commentary, your insights are deeply appreciated. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Simon. And if I could leave your listeners with one thought, it would be recover a sense of wonder. Get out into the world, be relational, touch the grass, just live a little bit. Don't be dragged into the machine constantly.
If I then might be, you're right. Can I encourage people to do it? Go out and do a walk right now, but take your RCR app and your AirPods as you do now. Brendan, thank you so much. We'll have you back on.
Thanks, Simon.
So that was Brendan Malone, a cultural commentator, director at LifeNet. And if you want to hear more of what he has to say, jump onto his podcast called On the Dispatches. And if you've got any thoughts, feedback, challenges, criticism, critiques, compliments about what he and I were discussing, get in touch. That's inbox@realitycheck.radio or text 2057.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas, from great looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers and more. The RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.